disorder.
Right. What is the name and occupation of your partner or spouse?
Michael, and he's an insurance adjuster.
How many children do you have, if any?
One son, who's 11. And no grandchildren. Although, you laugh, I mean, even my younger brother has children who have children who are almost as old as my child. So they started early and I started late.
Where did you attend school and what degrees have you earned?
I did an associate degree at Shoreline Community College in Seattle, and then I transferred to the University of Washington. I did a bachelor's of English and then a master's of English, and then I went to Indiana University, and I did a PhD in English, and then minors in medieval studies and women's studies.
Is there anything else in your general background that you think would be important for us to know?
I think it comes out in the questions that you ask.
Okay. So let's look at your childhood and adolescence. Tell me about the community and neighborhood you grew up in.
Well, that I thought was an interesting question because there wasn't one. My family moved a lot. My father had problems with drinking and drugs and mental health problems, and so I went to two kindergartens, and there were a couple periods where things stabilized. Second and third grade, I went to one school, and then fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, I went to another school, and then things kind of got rocky, and I went to three seventh grades. And so we did a lot of moving, and so there's not a sense of, we're thinking neighborhood and community, multiple neighborhoods and communities, but almost all of them in Seattle, around Seattle. There was a period when I was a teenager that my mother was trying to leave my father, and so she sent us to Georgia, and I lived in a small town there, and it was pretty horrible. Small towns are not good for certain people, I think. And then she came, and they got back together, and they moved back to Seattle. And so lots of communities. There's not one.
Georgia.
Pardon me?
Who was in Georgia?
My mother's mother was in Georgia. So she sent us there, my younger brother and me. They sent us there, and they were trying to hospitalize my father, and she did that, and then she came, but then he followed her. So
you probably really answered this next one. Describe how your family was or was not connected to the community.
Well, I think about that a lot, you know, in relation to thinking about the difference between my 11-year-old son, who's very privileged, and, you know, his life is very different than my life was, and but he goes to a school where there are children who are not so privileged. He's at Lakeshore, and thinking about, for me, I think living in a bigger city can sometimes be advantageous if you're from a family that's dysfunctional. I think that in the times that we lived in smaller towns and people knew our business, it was harder for us as kids, whereas when we were in bigger cities and people didn't really know what was going on, they assumed we were like everyone else. And you know, people sort of, you know, talk about small towns having community and caring, but I don't know that that's always true. So, I mean, I think those are the kinds of things that I think most about when I was younger and being fortunate at, I think, important points in my life, living in urban settings and living, you know, in the early 60s, a lot of social programs in place to help kids who didn't have a lot of resources, being a Head Start kid, thinking about even the resources for my mother, who, you know, was a teen parent. And So I guess that's what I think about, but not connected to community in the way that now I feel connected to a community. I mean, I'm one of those middle-class people now.
So when you talk power, you're really also talking about power and privilege in communities and how it affected your family.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing a difference then, depending on where you
are. Yeah, certainly.
Anything else about power and privilege?
I mean, I think certainly being white helps pass through. I think pass, it's easier to pass as middle class, the assumptions that get made about you. And not being rural. I mean, not having a rural accent, or, you know, thinking about assumptions that get made about people's accents, too. Those kinds of things. Which I think has to do with power and privilege.
Yeah. Looking back at your childhood, would you have anticipated that you would become a feminist later in life?
I didn't anticipate that I would be a feminist, but looking back, it's not surprising, I think, because my mother was very strong, and she was really what held the family together, and she died when she was 50, so I wasn't at home anymore, but it was pretty clear that after she died, she was what was holding things together, so, you know, a strong mother in the house, keeping things, and thinking about experiences that I had as a child, when I was a kid, it's probably true when you were a kid, girls couldn't wear pants to school, and if it snowed, it rarely snows in Seattle, but if it did, we could wear them under skirts, and I remember one time wearing pants with no skirt over them, and being sent home and thinking it was horribly unjust, because we would climb this rockery around the baseball field, and the boys would look up our skirts, and, you know, so, I mean, that's sort of a, you know, outrage at gender inequity at, I think it was probably 8 at the time. But they had dress codes, I think, probably until, oh, gosh, I can't remember if in 5th and 6th grade if we were allowed to wear pants, or if that didn't happen until middle school. I'd have to think back about, I don't know, I'm sure I could sort of pinpoint the details by looking at, you know, pictures and stuff, but, yeah.
Was there anything else about your childhood experience that you'd like to share?
I don't know. I don't know if this is childhood or not, just like I should have made notes, I suppose. I was thinking, when I got into high school, too, sort of thinking about reactions that I had to boyfriends and mothers, and how the mothers were treated. Remember one time having dated a boy in high school who the youngest was sort of moving out of high school too, and so his mother came home and said that she was going to make some big changes in their lives, and that that there was someone else besides them that mattered to her. And I somehow knew that she was talking about herself, but they all thought she was having an affair. And what it was that she had taken the civil service exam and was going to go back to work. And so I think in hindsight, I mean, it's those kind of things, sort of thinking, you know, sort of being, again, kind of outraged at the lack of respect that sometimes I would see for people's mothers. I think that sort of was telling, but nobody called them. I mean, most of the people we knew weren't college educated, so they weren't calling themselves feminists. And I think probably in the 60s, I don't know, were a lot of non-college people calling themselves feminists? I don't know. They weren't where I lived, but,
yeah.
You know, in hindsight, it's not surprising, but I wouldn't have guessed at the time.
Describe your educational path after high school.
Well, I wanted to go to college, but I actually stopped living with my family at 15, and so for me it was very different. I didn't go to college until I was in my mid-20s. I'm sort of first-generation high school. None of my siblings finished high school. My parents didn't finish high school. And in fact, when we lived in Georgia, they all moved back to Seattle, and I didn't go with them. I stayed to finish the school year there, and I was 15. And so I lived on a farm and worked on the farm to sort of pay my room and board. And then when I moved, at the end of the year, I moved back with them. But then they kept moving, and it's hard to go to school, especially in high school, when they kept moving. So when I was 16, I was an emancipated minor, and so I worked. It's funny because they called it early release, so it sounds like prison. But I would take classes till 1, and then I worked at McDonald's full time and to pay rent on a little studio apartment. And so when I was done, I wanted to go to high school. I wanted to go to college, but I didn't have the money for it. And I tried moving home again, but my father's illness were really, I couldn't do it. So I moved out again, and I was working in a department store as, back in the days when department stores sold furniture and drapes, and they had, I was actually, they called a decorating consultant, and I liked it. So I went out, and I took samples to people's homes, and it was on commission, so it wasn't bad money for, you know, an 18-year-old. And I thought, well, okay, I'll do this. And it wasn't a bad life, but one of the things that happened was they started building malls in the 80s. This was about 1980. And they built a new branch of the store at this mall that was sort of further from my home. And they started laying people off who, you know, they do this in cycles. When you're young, you don't know about the cycles, right? So they started laying people off. So I saw these people who were, you know, in their middle ages losing their jobs, and then discovering that there was a sort of pattern of this, and I thought, well, this is really scary. And at that time, I was living with the person who now became my husband. So I went to the new job, but I was just didn't like it, didn't feel secure anymore, and really still wanted to go back to college. So he said, go. So because my job was flexible enough, I worked full-time for a couple of years, and went to the community college for 2 years. And then I cut back to 30 hours and went to the university. But it was hard because we lived north of Seattle, so I had to commute. And then my last year, sort of the last 6 months, I cut back a little bit. And by then I decided to go into grad school. And that was the exciting part. It was the scary part because we pulled up roots and went to Indiana. But that was the first time that I'd ever been sort of in that college experience where I didn't finish my classes and have to go flying off to work or whatever. So that was sort of how I ended up in college, was that way. And then once I got into college, I never left. Here I am.
So your occupational path after college
is here. It was here. Yeah, I finished at Indiana, and then my first job was in Birmingham, Alabama. I got a job down there. In the English department there, and Birmingham's a rough place to be, I think, for someone who's not a Southerner, and I hate the heat. I really hate the heat. And then my son was born down there, and, you know, English professors don't make what people think they make, and the schools in our neighborhood, we had a really nice neighborhood, but the schools were physically not usable. The ceilings were falling in, and the books were God knows how old, and to move into the other districts was really expensive. We just made lists of the things that we liked about Birmingham and the things that we didn't, and the didn't like list was really long, so I went on the market again, and we ended up here, where the schools are good, and the weather's not so hot.
Okay, when and how were you awakened to social inequalities based on gender, race, social class, sexual orientation, and other layers of identity?
I think, you know, in layers, like from early on, I mean, just thinking about, you know, watching the differences between my parents. And I remember at one point, my father always, when he did work, made more money than my mother did, but he didn't work consistently. And I remember at one point my mother telling him that she had done the math, and in spite of the fact that he makes more money, she had made as much money just having to work full time. So those kinds of things. And then, I mean, it was just always little pieces here and there. You know, like I said, you know, being in friends' homes and being at school and watching differences between how certain people got treated in other ways. And, you know, as I went to college, meeting people who were even more different than I was. And, you know, in high school, there weren't any out gays and lesbians. I mean, there were certainly gays and lesbians, but they weren't out. So it wasn't until I got into college that there were people who were actually out as gays and lesbians. And so then, you know, actually having upfront conversations about things. I mean, certainly as a kid, the part of Seattle that I grew up in was fairly diverse for Seattle. You know, from an early age, already having conversations about race with kids that I knew. So it's just all in pieces, sort of, I mean, over time. And then being in college, it was something that you could actually study. And as a kid, I didn't know that that was something that you could actually study. If that makes sense.
Describe the process you went through as you decided to identify as a feminist.
Well, that's funny because in college, the label kind of got put on me and another classmate. I've been thinking about this in relation to in the academe, one of the you know, college periodicals that comes out had a piece by Mark Edmondson. I don't know if you know who he is, but he writes about liberal education, and he was, you know, talking about just read and that instead of using theories, we should just read. But my feeling was the irony is he sort of prefaces it with this thinking about Arnold and Whitman, maybe, I forget now, some American authors. And I thought, well, those are sort of his models, too. But anyway, when I was in college, I was in a Hawthorne Melville Poe class, and we were reading Moby Dick. And this other woman and I, you know, it was being taught to us as this great American novel about the human experience, about what it means to be American. And have you ever read Moby Dick?
I've tried.
Yeah, well. basically, you know, you have to leave the women behind. And so the great American experience is about leaving women behind and, you know, not being stifled by domesticity. But the domesticity is the women's domesticity that might stifle you, the male person. So this other woman in the class and I would raise our hands and say, well, what about here? What about here? And so the teacher, you know, eventually started sort of derisively would say, well, what do the feminists have to say? And I'd never called myself a feminist. And so, I mean, not that I hadn't really thought about it. There weren't classes on feminism or women's studies or any of those things happening. And I think the 80s were kind of a weird lull after the excitement of the 60s and 70s. I mean, even on a place like, you know, the University of Washington campus, you know, there were, in the Sousa Library, there were replacement windows where they'd been sort of bombed, you know, bombs had gone off in the square in between, on the plaza, and, you know, back in the early 70s during the war. And I think the 80s were kind of a, you know, not so radical time in a weird way. So there wasn't a lot of, I don't know, there must have been stuff happening on campus, and it's hard for me to say because a lot of my time was really as soon as classes were done. But anyway, so she and I would have coffee and talk about how, what we thought, you know, some of these problems were. And it wasn't until later that I read, like, Judith Betterly, who has this book on called The Resisting Reader, that talks about that for women to read American literature is to position yourself against yourself as a woman, or you know, that all the problematics of that. And so I think of that as part of the process, that feminism was a way to explain what a certain professor had sort of labeled as my inability to read properly. And so, I mean, I think that's, I think I've lost the question.
That was very interesting.
About being awakened.
Yes.
Yeah, the process of it. I
so
think of that as a piece of it.
That label from that, you, how did you feel?
I didn't feel it. I felt insulted because he was using it as an insult, but I don't know that it just wasn't a word that I had applied to myself. I hadn't really thought about, you know, I mean, there was Helen Reddy's "Hear Me, I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar," but I don't know. I didn't think, oh, that's not me. I just, and in fact, the irony is I thought, maybe that is me. And so, I mean, I suppose I could, if I were a different kind of soul, I would, you know, say, oh, he gave it to me as a gift, but I don't think so. You know, it didn't feel like a gift at the time. But I don't, I guess I felt more, I didn't like how he was using it. And I don't know that I felt particularly one way or the other about the word itself, if that makes sense.
So as you and this other woman started discussing this, is that kind of when you embraced it then, or identified as one, or would you say that was later?
Well, yeah, I'd say in a joking sort of way, we said, oh, yeah, we're the feminists, or, you know, that kind of thing.
So when did you decide, or did you ever say to family, people that cared about you, that you were a feminist, and what kind of resistance did you get from that?
Well, I suppose, I don't recall, like, coming out as a feminist or having, I mean, it's one of those things where I think people who had known me for a while, well, obviously that made sense, or I don't know that I recall any trouble with people that I knew or cared about. I think, and where I really started to embrace the term was when I got into graduate school, and that's where I met the Feminist Teacher Collective, and, you know, if you're going to be part of the Feminist Teacher Collective, you have to be a feminist. So it felt like it was I felt more trouble with strangers or students or those kinds of things. I mean, my mother wouldn't, I don't know that she would have called herself feminist. The word didn't get circulated in that way.
Well, what have been the greatest challenges you have faced as feminist?
I mean, I think mostly it's brought good things by being a feminist. So when I think about challenges, I think learning to let go of things I can't change, you know, like dealing with burnout and those kinds of things, and really with strangers and in the classroom a lot, you know, trying to get to work against that popular image that somehow feminism is women want to be in charge, women want to do what men have done to women, that it's simply flipping things upside down, you know, all the things that I think feminism isn't, but that conservatives want to say feminism is, or opponents of feminism want to claim it does, or even sometimes, I mean, thinking about my students, and that's where I feel a little conflicted is, you know, what does it mean, you know, if a student calls themselves a feminist and the way they define feminism is, I want to have a lot of power, in that sort of still patriarchal kind of power way, then I think, well, is it my right to say that's not really feminist? I mean, because they're claiming that term, but I'd say those are the struggles, is to think about, you know, like what the culture does, especially now that, you know, so much of our culture says, well, it's a post-feminist age, and it's not. At least I don't think it is.
So which of your contributions have made the greatest difference in shaping feminist theories and practices and your own understanding of yourself as a feminist? It's the hardest question.
I wasn't sure what that meant.
It's almost more like two, but think about your contributions.
To feminism?
Feminism, and also how they shape yourself and your understanding of yourself as a feminist.
I think certainly being involved with Feminist Teacher has been, I mean, from the beginning, I mean, I was a graduate student, and that really gave me a group of other graduate students who were ahead of me in academia, who mentored me, and I watched them, you know, those kinds of things. So I would say, well, that's not my contribution, but...
Well, you edit.
Yeah.
So can you expand on what that is for the audience?
For what working with Feminist Teacher is? Yeah, it's a journal, so... And it's about, it. The journal started actually before I was a graduate student. There was a feminist reading group at Indiana of graduate students, and I had been in the feminist reading group, and we were just reading feminist theory, different kinds, and we were starting to read some queer theory too, so like Judith Butler and Sedgwick, and I can't remember other stuff that we were reading at the time, and we read some race theory. We would just pick some stuff, and over the semester we would read. But this group, and you know how reading groups sort of form and unform and reform, and in an earlier group a few years before I had come to Indiana, the graduate group, everybody were, we were all TAs, and they wanted to read stuff on feminist pedagogy, and they discovered there wasn't any. And so, I wasn't there when it happened, but I sort of imagine it, like the old Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland, let's put on a barn show and raise money. And they did. They raised money, and they got their first issues out. So it was actually going when I got there. And Mary Bergan, who used to be the president of AAUP and is retired, was the chair of English, and she gave graduate money, like a TA-ship, to somebody to do editor work. And so they advertised for it, and I applied for it, and so that's why I got it. And so the work that they do is people turn in articles about teaching, and it's changed over the years. I mean, because in the 1980s there wasn't anything on feminist pedagogy, and now it's really a field. And so there's a scholarship on it that didn't exist before. So some of the pieces are very practical pieces, and some of the pieces are more theoretical pieces, and some are much more scholarly pieces. And there are 5, sometimes 6, sometimes 7 of us on the collective at different times. And so we get these articles. And part of what happens is you start reading about how other people teach and how people teach in feminist ways in other disciplines, because it's an interdisciplinary journal. Mm-hmm. And so you learn about, teaching in the sciences, for example, which is very far from what I do, or those kinds of things, or what it means to teach in a big city or to teach in Utah among Mormons, or, people have written about different experiences. And so that's, for me, very exciting. But it's, I could read the journal and get a lot of that too, but we also work with the authors a lot on their writing. So there's a kind of engagement with the authors. So there's a kind of feminist mentorship or pedagogy in the process of editing with people. I guess I suppose one way to look at it is we're really picky, but on the other hand, I think the articles end up much better, that they've come out of a kind of conversation. And it's interesting because some of the articles, the collective will, we don't work like a regular editorial board either, because we don't simply vote. We hash stuff out, and sometimes we'll go in and somebody will really hate an article and somebody else will really like it, and the decision is actually to take it because it generates discussion. Oftentimes, an article that creates a lot of heated discussion among the collective, that is part of the reason to choose it. Sometimes it generates a lot of discussion because they're really bad or something, but there are other ones where the the energy ends up being about the content of it, and we do disagree. We have very different positions on certain things, and so I think that's been really important to me. So watching this women and meeting new women who've joined the collective, or meeting people who've become authors, and it puts you in a kind of contact with people. And so I think that's been really important to me. I think
it's a great contribution. In a more general sense here, what do you consider the greatest achievement of feminism over the past 25 years?
Oh, gosh. I think trying to argue that women have value, and what women do has value. And that's where I think it gets difficult. I think that gets tied up for me to think about, like, what's the greatest obstacle or impediment to, sort of feminism, is thinking about reading my own students' oral histories and, interviewing mothers and grandmothers who say, well, the feminist movement has made it so women can't stay home with their children. And it's like, well, I don't think that's true. You know, I think, so we talk about, you know, well, what's the material value that's placed on mothering? What happens when a mother who's only worked at home and her working out in the world husband split, how does the money go like that? You know, those kinds of things. So I think feminism's greatest strength have been to try and call attention to the way in which what women do in the home is work, and that the work that they do outside of the home is often valued inequitably. I think that's been really important. I think talking to each other, I think the arguments and discussions that women have, and then when women of color say, but hey, what you're talking about as women here doesn't include this group of women, and you know, so different groups of people talking, I think the talking helps.
So what do you see as the most important challenges feminists must overcome in this country?
I guess the same thing. I mean, that we keep talking and that we keep being willing to face the hard questions about, you know, who are we, you know, and who is not me but is also part of we, and being open to that and thinking about, you know, differences in women's lives, and how do you support them? I know for me, that's one of the really hard ones. It's like, who was I reading? I was reading somebody, and they were posing that question, you know, like, if you want to support women, and there's, you know, women who, you know, are like Serena Joy, and just this semester we were reading The Handmaid's Tale, or, you know, someone who's anti-choice, I mean, not just personally against abortion, but wants no one to have access to it, or, you know, isn't just personally wanting to stay home, but really wants to reform the culture. Like, how do you support someone like that who's, you know, how do you support women when some women have ideas that are so opposite to what you think of? I think men are important, not as, I guess as a challenge too, but I think getting men, coming back to achievements, I think having men involved, you know, that idea that, like, bell hooks is feminism is for everyone, which is connected, I think, to sort of making sure that people understand what feminism really is.
Thank you. Let's move now to more focused on UWEC Women's Studies program.
Uh-huh.
How long and in what ways have you been engaged with the UWEC Women's Program?
I feel like I sort of fell off the charts over the last few years because of, you know, sort of duties in English, although I've been teaching the women's lit class, so that's been a nice, but that doesn't feel connected to the other faculty. I don't feel like I've missed that a lot. But when I interviewed for the job here, I think I didn't interview with Sarah Harder, but somebody arranged a meeting with her, so I got to meet her. So I think from the very beginning, I wanted to be involved in women's studies. It was a couple of years, I think, before I actually got to teach a women's lit class, and then a few years after that, I taught Women's Studies 301. That was, at that point, it was really among the things that I was looking for when I left Birmingham. Women's studies wasn't very supported. My department chair and dean didn't recognize the value of feminist teacher. They didn't understand, I mean, it's actually a fairly important journal, and they didn't seem to get that. So part of what I wanted when I left was to go someplace where I wasn't having to constantly say, this is as important as, you know, the Faulkner newsletter, which isn't to demean the Faulkner newsletter, but, you know, they had heard of Faulkner. They'd never somehow heard of feminist teacher. So that was good when I came.
So you joined that when you came. What was your first memory of the program?
Oh, gosh. I think the first thing I really remember was I got asked to review student projects for the awards. I mean, there may have been something before then. I may have gone to a meeting, but that was the thing that stood out in my mind, was looking at these student projects and thinking, wow, this is really cool. And Harry Harder was there, and I thought, wow, here's this, I think he might have even been retired at that time. So here's somebody they pulled out of retirement who's involved in women's studies, and, you know, I so I remember that, thinking, okay, this is good. It's not just, it's old people, it's young people, it's students, and the students are doing really interesting things.
How do you think it's changed over?
Well, I think radically, because when Sarah retired, you know, so I was here when Jenny was the interim director, and there was that summer when Sarah left, and I mean, it's one of those sad things where, I mean, clearly the university was taking advantage of her, and so, but it wasn't until she left that then everyone else could say, we're not going to do this unless, you know, you step up. And so I would say that's been one of the big changes, is getting, you know, getting more, a bigger chunk of FTE for the program coordinator, and then the creation of the major. I would say those are huge things. Probably the biggest things, I suppose.
What are the major contributions of UWBC Women's Studies to the campus community and beyond?
I mean, certainly having a major and a minor, and you think about how many students who get that degree and then have this understanding of women as a subject, gender and sexuality and race and all those things connected. I think the general ed contributions are probably really important to the campus, and then as those students go out to the community, to bring that out into the community. And I suppose thinking about what I think is one of the obstacles is sort of teaching people what feminism really is. I think they're the ones who will do that, probably informally, by saying, well, I'm a feminist, and here's what I'm thinking. You know, I'm not out here to become the queen of the universe.
Share any stories of people or events that you think are significant in shaping the 25-year history of women's studies at UWBC.
I don't know if I have. I couldn't think of any stories, but I do think that summer when were you around that summer when Sarah retired? And I remember there was this flurry of panic, and I remember sort of meeting with Margaret and Sheila, Jan, bunches of Patty was probably in there, and it was like, what are we going to do? Who's going to step up, and who's going to do this? And, you know, so I remember that being a kind of exciting time, and you know, then when Jenny stepped up, thinking, wow, this is really great. And then, I think having Susan come and take that position on full time, I mean, she just seems to have done amazing things with, bringing women's studies and feminist concerns out across campus. But I don't know, those aren't really stories. I don't know if I have any good anecdotes, I don't think.
What do you consider your major contribution to the success of the program?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I suppose teaching. I guess I do think, my sense has been that a lot of the work that gets done has been really collaborative, and I like that. I like that a lot, and I do think that a lot of the work that's been done through women's studies has been very feminist. The committees are oftentimes feel very different than other kinds of committees. I remember when I was in Birmingham chairing the Faculty Affairs Committee, and the dean came in one time, and we actually got a lot done that semester, but he said some kind of snarky comment about how things were being run, and basically was giving me advice that I needed to have to be more in charge, and I thought, and I remember saying something, I've always worked in collectives, I'm a feminist, I'm a feminist. I don't work that way. And so I do think the committees and the kinds of projects that get that happen here. Well, I think that first, I don't even know if we had a title or anything. I think it was just sort of drafting the demands for restructuring the women's studies program, and insist what we took to. I think Ted went. Was Ted the dean? I don't remember now exactly. I think Ted might have been the dean at the time. Ted went. But needing a space because we were sort of being pushed out of Haas, and so that was one. That was probably the first real kind of committee. And then I think I was on the steering committee right away. And so I worked on that. I was part of the program review committee, and that was really interesting to watch that happen. And that was the first time that I had a lot of conversation with students who were, at the time, in the minors, that were minors, because we didn't have majors at the time. And I think we'd done the program review in anticipation of a major. And so that was exciting to sort of have those conversations, like to officially have those conversations. And then, like I said, I just felt like everything, there was so much to do in English that I haven't been on a women's studies committee for a while, but I just finished the university committee last year. This year ended that duty, so I put my name in. So hopefully I'll get elected to serve again and feel like I'm connected a little more. Yeah.
What would you like your legacy for the women's studies program to be?
I guess students. I mean, thinking about students, and before when we were talking about the achievements and the benefits and the challenges, when I think about the campus stuff, then I think it's the students the most. And thinking about how do you create space for women to find what feminism is for them, to find their voices, to find their actions, to learn about other women, to make those kinds of connections. And then at the same time thinking about, the men on our campus, and oftentimes they don't take the women's studies classes, they take the diversity credits, and I think about that, like the ways in which, by making women's studies its own major and its own discipline, there's a way in which then that sort of ghettoizes it, I guess. And so, coming back to thinking about, I hope that we and when I think about a legacy, I don't think there's any, the things that I want are things that I could do alone. Those would be the things, is how do you shift so that, the study of women is central and that people are being exposed to it all the time and not only when they can't escape it or that it's over there so I don't have to worry about taking it over. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
I'm going to skip 23 because you kind of worked about that, and then because there's one more that I think is on there. I know you. Did you feel like you had to leave at 3?
No, I'm okay.
Okay. Yeah, okay. And then we'll take 23 as well.
Okay.
As you think about the future, what role do you think women's studies will play on the UW-Eau Claire campus community and beyond? Mm-hmm. You kind of started that.
Yeah. Everything seems sort of a lot of anxiety, I think, about the university in general these days. And so I think, I hope that women's studies will, I guess, continue to make women central in the sense of not the focus, but, that when we think about different disciplines or history or categories that human gets redefined. So I think I hope that will still happen even more. And again, sort of thinking about, well, I think you have to have women's studies as its own place, but I think it can't only be women's studies without it being in other places. So I hope women's studies just keeps fighting the good fight. And if it does, then I think, you know, that will come out into the community. I mean, because the students, I mean, I do think that that's the powerful thing about, you know, when you teach students, they take that off and talk to other people and argue with other people and bring their ideas to other people. And so, you know, education is very powerful.
Well, the last question, maybe you need a few minutes to think, it's simply, what story is most important for you to tell as part of the oral history project?
No. I have questions rather than, I don't know what I have.
So is there anything about the history you really would like people to know?
About the history of women's studies here at Eau Claire?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know the details of, I mean, that was the thing that I thought was so amazing, you know, when Sarah retired, was all these other women, like Carol Fairbanks, and I can't think of all the names. I mean, I think those are the stories. I mean, the stories of all those women, and I'm assuming you guys were interviewing them, yeah? Yeah. I think they're the stories, you know, you know, of course we wouldn't be here if they hadn't felt compelled to teach the classes and make the demands that they had made. And
anything related personally to you, any story about the oral history project, something, well, not about the project, but about our history?
And I think I told the story, so.
Okay. That's fine.
Yeah.
Now, in case I forgot to say, did I the second time around, did I say time and place? And
I think you did, okay. That we're in the Wage Center and the date. I think you did.
Okay.
Although I don't know what day it is. But I was thinking about, you know, as an academic feminist and the demands of academia, and then having, you know, an elementary school kid who I enjoy the time, you know, and wanting to make sure that I give that time. I'm thinking about the activism piece. And that's something that I don't have a good sense of, is like how much activism is happening here. And just because I'm not seeing it doesn't mean it's not happening. But I think about when I was in graduate school and before my son was born, you know, the kind of activism that felt like it was all around me. And I don't know if I think that's a challenge too, is, you know, people being so occupied in all kinds of, you know, like, I think that's an important word for us right now, being occupied, like in a military sense, but, you know, our time is occupied, and, you know, thinking about how do you change things, both on campus and off campus, through activism. And, you know, I guess what made me think about that was thinking about those early faculty members, and the kind of work that they did to get the program going was itself a kind of activism, whereas now it's, a lot of it is institutionalized. And that's a debate in feminism and women's studies, that academic activist question, what's the relationship? I think that's probably both a source of potential and a challenge for us too. At least it is for me.
Thank you. I think that's
a good tradition. Okay.